attention to in that first budget, the one that came right after Act 10.
The details of those changes, if they happen, should become more clear over the next several months. In the meantime, Republicans have said their first priority will be a rewrite of Wisconsin's mining laws. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The new legislative session will get underway today with plenty of pomp and circumstance. New state representatives are sworn in this afternoon, followed by a reception at the State Historical Museum. The state Senate will hold a lunchtime reception, followed by an inauguration ceremony that will run simultaneously with the assembly proceedings. Each new senator will receive a lapel pin. Dozens of scientists, policymakers, and advocates will meet this week to start planning a long-term strategy to protect and restore the Great Lakes. It starts Wednesday in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They'll review the forces which have shaped the Great Lakes region in the past and forces that will shape the Great Lakes in the future. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
You may have seen headlines like this last week. A few extra pounds may cut risk of early death. So, can we all stop worrying about our weight now? Good morning, I'm Rob Ferret, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week at 7 minutes after 6 on Monday, January 7th. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we'll look at a study that got a lot of press coverage suggesting that more weight might have a health benefit. Also in the news, a new poll says we have mixed feelings about what, if anything, the government should do to fight obesity. My guest this hour is Patrick Remington. He's professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison and associate dean of public health at the UW-Madison School of Medicine. He joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Well, based on this study and the headlines we've seen, can we throw away those scales and eat some chips?
No, that's not the take-home message from this research. I think there's a finding that's true, that when you look at I think there are about 3 million people in all these studies that were combined, about 97 studies were looked at. And when you look at observational studies, in other words, there was no intervention, there was no experiment, that people who are a little bit heavier than what we would consider normal weight have a 6% lower likelihood of dying. First of all, the 6% is pretty small. That's only 6 in 100. But second is that when they looked at people who were quite a bit heavier, using this measure body mass index, that they actually had a 30% higher risk of dying. So I think the take-home message is simply the observation. If you observe 3 million people, and I think there were a 250,000 deaths in that in all these studies combined, that people who are a little heavier, considered slightly overweight, have a slightly lower risk of dying.
Well, let's untangle a couple things. Lower risk of dying doesn't mean healthy necessarily. Talk about the idea of mortality, morbidity, and health.
Well, absolutely. There are a number of reasons the people with a little bit of overweight, and that might be 20 pounds over their what they might consider ideal body weight. One thing that the investigators did not account for is the fact that these people could actually have pre-existing conditions, chronic illness. And so that could increase their risk of dying. In other words, normal weight people are normal or low weight because they have chronic illness. The second thing is our healthcare system has done a pretty good job of identifying people who are slightly overweight and managing their conditions like diabetes or cholesterol. And it might be that that lower risk in people who are overweight is due to medical surveillance and intervention.
So if I'm 20 pounds overweight, that's a red flag for my doctor, for the healthcare system. They're saying, we're going to intervene with you a little more. Whereas if I'm at my target weight, I might not get that attention. I might have a condition that gets overlooked.
You might not even go see the doctor. Sometimes people avoid preventive checkups if they don't perceive that they have a medical problem. Absolutely.
Rob Ferret here talking to Patrick Remington about obesity, overweight. A new study says a little bit of extra weight makes us a little less likely to die in the short run. But there may be a lot of health conditions that are being overlooked in that study. Call in with your questions at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And in this new year, are you trying to lose weight? eat better, exercise more? Tell us how it's going and what obstacles you're encountering and what might help you. And what do you think of something we'll get into in a few minutes, requiring nutritional labels on restaurant food or higher taxes on soda and other high-calorie, low-nutrition foods? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Before we get into what the government might do, Patrick Remington, let's talk a little bit about what's the difference between overweight and obese.
Well, there's a whole 30 or 40 year history of how we classify people's body weight. It used to be back in the 1960s that we'd compare someone's weight to an ideal body weight. It would be developed from a table. And then about 20 years ago, the World Health Organization developed this scale called Body Mass Index. I'm sure people have heard of BMI. Mm-hmm. What's your BMI? And that's simply your weight divided by your height in meters squared. And it's a bit hard to calculate. You can do it on the internet if you want. But that was used for research purposes, and it's a very crude measure of what we would like to measure, which is risk of disease and death, measures not only of obesity or fatness, but the distribution of that fat. So it's a very crude measure that can be used in studies, and it turns out is probably not a very good measure for risk of disease, as shown in this study. People can be have a high body mass index from having a lot of muscle. From being stocky, and people can be a normal body mass index but have a lot of fat distributed in places that increase risk. So it's a very imprecise tool. It's used in research because it's easy to measure someone's height and weight. It's harder to do waist circumference and actually skin fold thickness and look at distribution of adipose tissue, fat tissue.
And I think that's a theme we're probably going to come back to again and again. This is more complicated than it looks at the first glance.
It is very complicated. some people argue that this kind of research should be done within the scientific community and debated. If you look online over the weekend, you'll see researchers like Walter Willett from Harvard calling this complete rubbish, to others who are saying that this vindicates the consumer movement that says that we've medicalized obesity simply to make money from weight loss, and society is too concerned with ideal body weight.
And with this study, the one we've been talking about, suggesting that a little extra weight helps us live longer, do you think the media has grabbed that and run with it and missed some of the nuance that may have even been there from the study's authors in the first place?
You read the last paragraph of this paper. The study's authors put all sorts of caveats in it about caution and overinterpreting this paper. I think the major point that you made is that this looks at length of life but not quality of life. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that with increasing pounds, your risk of diabetes increases, arthritis, heart disease, some cancers. About a third of breast cancer, in fact, in women over the age of 50 is thought to be due to postmenopausal obesity. So you line up all these what we call morbid conditions, diseases, even if people live as long or maybe even slightly longer, they're not living as well. And so the quality of life is reduced with increased weight. But these investigators, they acknowledged they didn't look at that. But the headlines skip right through that and almost sensationalize the results.
So even if I live a bit longer, it may not be, I may be in a lot of pain or receiving a lot of constant medical treatment for these conditions you just listed.
Yeah, absolutely. And the medical system does a pretty good job of treating some of the consequences of overweight. We have pills to bring down cholesterol. We have pills to control high blood pressure, which is directly related to one's body weight. We have pills even to control type 2 diabetes. So once you become overweight or obese, the medical care system does have treatments that can help. But again, I think most people would prefer to stay out of the doctor's office and stay well.
That's Patrick Remington with the UW-Madison School of Medicine. We're talking about being overweight or being obese and what it means for our health. In just a few minutes, we'll get into what, if anything, the government should do about it. Some new polling information says We like some things, not so wild about others when it comes to government interventions. You can join the show at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Is there something you'd like to see the government do? Do you think large-size sodas should be banned, as Mayor Bloomberg worked on in New York City? Do you think there should be taxes on unhealthy foods? What's an unhealthy food, if so? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the weather, today mostly sunny around the state with highs in the low to mid-30s. Tonight mostly clear with lows in the teens and 20s. Tomorrow turning cloudy with highs in the mid to upper 30s, lows in the teens and 20s. Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 30s, lows in the teens, 20s, and low 30s. Coming up after 11 today, Larry Mueller talks to Peter Green about computers. Did you get a new technological device for the holidays? And now you want to figure out how to use it? Tune in with Larry from 11 to 12:30. Call in with your questions. This hour, we're looking at obesity and whether being overweight is healthy or unhealthy. A new study says it might, if you're a little overweight, help you live a little longer. But my guest, Patrick Remington, says the quality of life might not be so great. Patrick Remington, I mentioned a few minutes ago the government and what it can do about overweight and obesity. A new poll from the AP says a lot of us like some of the things the government could do. Nutritional labeling on restaurant foods, schools, encouraging more activity, better eating for kids. We are not wild about banning foods or taxing unhealthy foods. What do you make of that new polling information?
Well, I think it makes sense. People think of the government as an abstract concept and this Big Brother view. But many people, when they get involved in their school or in their community, come together and collectively make decisions that improve the environment in which kids live or where we live and work, so that things like improving nutrition at schools, people don't think about that as a government policy. Mm-hmm. It's a rule, certainly, and most schools are public. People also think about designing communities so that they're safe and walkable, try and put sidewalks in where they maybe haven't been, put a bike path in. So I think if you think in abstract terms, government, you know, Big Brother interventions to tell us what we can and can't do, most people don't like that. But if you get involved in your community or in your school and you think about creating the conditions where it's easier to live a healthier lifestyle, make the healthy choices the easier choices, most people are in support of that.
We can dig into that a little more, but we'll get to the phones now. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you think of requiring restaurants to post nutritional information? Would you want to see higher taxes on soda and other apparently unhealthy foods, or banning large-sized sodas? Or you could just tell your story. Are you trying to lose weight in the new year? How's it going? Just 7 days into 2013. To the phones now. Ruth in Madison is with us. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I'm 60. Most of my adult life until menopause, I was 10 to 15 pounds underweight. My target weight was about 120, 125, and I ran, you know, like somewhere between 105 and 115 was where I was. I was last carded for alcohol, to buy alcohol, when I was 36 years old. Hit menopause at 46. And that was about the same time as they started putting bovine growth hormone in just about everything we eat. But so I've gained now where I'm, they still think I should be 120. I'm 60. I'm not 18. I'm 60. And so I'm about 40 pounds overweight by their standards. Now, my A1C is fine. My blood pressure is 100 over 60. My heart rate is 60. My cholesterol is 152, 80 of which is the good cholesterol.
All right.
Okay.
So do you need to lose weight?
My grandmother's, one lived to be 98 years and 11 months. The other died 2 hours before her 105th birthday.
I'm going to cut in there, Ruth. You gave us a lot of detail to work with. The first thing that Ruth makes me think is what we mentioned a few minutes ago, Patrick Remington. It's complicated, and there's more than just the weight and the BMI to look at.
Yes, it's absolutely true. And I think we focus much too much on body weight. Much of the variation we see in body weight is determined by our genetics, our family history. So if you have the same population doing the same exercise pattern and eating the same foods, you'll see a distribution from people who are lower weight to people who are overweight. The most important thing is to have a healthy diet and to be physically active. And when you do that, those numbers that she cited, hemoglobin A1C, most people don't actually know what that is.
That I did not know, no.
That's a measure of the glucose that's actually hooked onto your hemoglobin, and it's a long-term measure of your control of diabetes. So her hemoglobin A1C, her blood pressure, her cholesterol, and in fact, the good point of the good cholesterol, pulse rate, resting pulse rate, those are numbers that doctors measure and pay attention to. So if someone is categorized as 20 or 30 pounds overweight, but those medical numbers, those risk factors for heart disease and early death are good, then we should focus less on the overweight and more on the things that make those numbers good, like eating right and being physically active.
Well, let's key in on that number that everybody seems to watch, the actual weight. How many pounds do we weigh? Do we get just too caught up in that and too focused on that and maybe even discouraged if even though we're exercising, eating a little healthier, we're not making that one number go down?
Yeah, I think we focus absolutely too much on the body weight. First of all, it changes very slowly. And second, it's not a very good individual measure of your health risk. So it is good to see your doctor to understand what your blood pressure is and your cholesterol and other risks for disease. But the things you can keep track of are the amount and quality of the food you eat and whether you're physically active. And if you do that, then the body weight will be determined largely by your genetics. But your health risks, even if you're in this overweight category, if you're active, eating right, and have these good profile of metabolic measures, then you'll live a longer and healthier life than somebody who's normal weight but has high blood pressure and at risk for diabetes.
But then when we're talking about obesity, being very overweight, there's a point where maybe bringing down that weight number is important in and of itself?
Well, there's no question, even in this study, that the risk of dying prematurely for those who are, and the body mass index is 35 or greater, so quite a bit overweight, is significantly greater. And that goes up 30%, 50%, and all sorts of diseases come into play, not just heart disease, as you might think, and diabetes, but many cancers, arthritis is increased, just the wear and tear on the joints. So that there's no question, even from this research, that significant overweight is related to poor health.
And that was another thing in this AP poll we've been talking about. Most people can say, yes, overweight. If I'm overweight, there's higher risk for diabetes, higher risk for my heart. People don't think about cancer, about the arthritis you mentioned. I think sleep apnea was another thing mentioned in the report I read.
Yes, there's, well, you could list just about every chronic illness. Mm. And just as smoking relates to many cancers, heart disease, chronic breathing problems, many chronic illnesses are caused by or made worse by significant obesity.
Rob Verrett filling in for Joy Cardine, talking to UW-Madison public health expert Patrick Remington. Back to the phones now at 800-642-1234 with Giselle in Littleshoot. Hi, Giselle.
Hi, good morning. I just have a question. I was diagnosed with lupus like in 2011 in April, and I was about 198 pounds at that point. And when I started getting treatment for that, I dropped 50 pounds in 2 months while I was trying to get the lupus under control. And now I've been stuck at like maybe 155 ever since I dropped that much weight. And I'm wondering, how do you get by that plateau weight? I've been trying to eat well and exercise extremely you know, trying to keep lots of water, but I just can't get over that weight.
Gotcha, Giselle. Now, the lupus may be a big complicating factor. I don't know how that fits in, but the concept of I'm stuck at my plateau weight is probably something that a lot of people out there are contending with. Is that something we should be worrying about, Patrick Remington?
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head. The point is if you're exercising and you're eating a healthy diet, that weight, sort of our set weight that we get down to or stay at, is sometimes out of our control. So I would just focus on your lifestyle, eating and exercising, eating a good diet and exercising. But then it's a good idea to have a checkup every once in a while and ask about those numbers, the cholesterol number, the blood pressure, whether you're at risk of diabetes. And if those numbers are in the normal range, then I think you just get on with it. Don't worry about the weight that you're set at. And in fact, research has shown that it's very difficult if you're already physically active and eating right to continue to drop pounds.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Giselle, and good luck dealing with that lupus and with your weight. So in our last couple minutes before the news, Patrick Remington, are we getting the message about healthier eating and exercise? Probably everybody has heard it, but are we actually doing it?
Well, there's two answers to that question. The individuals seem to be more aware and trying hard to maintain normal body weight if you are in that normal body weight category, or to shed pounds. But the second part is more challenging. It's changing the environment in which we live that's created the obesity epidemic. We know that the population is significantly heavier than it used to be, and that comes from changes in the way we live and work. That's harder to do. And so I think awareness and self-discipline is important, but also changing the environment in which you live is even more important.
So the way we live and work would be, I'll speak for myself, I have a very sedentary job. I'm sitting right now and sit most of the day. That's one of the changes you're talking
Absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. Most of us now with digital devices and infrared technology barely have to lift a finger throughout the day. And so because we're not expending those calories that we used to expend 20 or 30 years ago, we need to design those into our lifestyle. And that turns out to be harder to change environments and change policies where we live and work.
Talking to Patrick Remington, he's professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison, associate dean of public health at the UW-Madison School of Medicine. He's joining us this hour, and he'll stay with us after the news. We're talking about obesity and overweight America. How much should we be worried about the number on the scale versus just exercise and better eating? And what, if anything, should the government do about it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, I'm talking to Patrick Remington, professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison. He's associate dean of public health at the UW-Madison School of Medicine. We'll continue our conversation now about being overweight, being obese, how bad it is for our health, what we can do about it as individuals, but also as a society. And Patrick Remington, just before the break, we touched on our sedentary lifestyles. And you've mentioned or have been thinking about what we can do collectively as a society to make it easier for individuals to lose weight or keep the weight off. What kind of things are you looking for?
Well, despite the debate about the relationship between obesity and mortality risk or quality of life, there's no debate that the last 20 years has seen a dramatic increase in the number of people who have been gaining weight, kids, young adults, older adults, men and women. And we know the two contributors to that are less active lifestyles. Again, the changing society with digital technology has made us less active, and food is more available, more calorie-dense, fast food, junk food, etc. So to me, you can focus on the individual and just hit us all, you know, respectively over the heads and say, you know, you ought to exercise and eat right. But I like to think about designing your home, your school, your workplace, the community, so that those choices that we used to make easily are easier to make today. And so that requires a lot of involvement with your community, with your school, to think about those policies on the types of foods that kids are served, on how your community is designed, on incentives for bike riding or taking a bus as opposed to driving. And all those policy decisions collectively could create an environment where it's easier to eat a healthy diet and easier to get exercise during the day.
So what happens when we're out of school and we're trying to eat better, but there are, you know, blooming onion batter fried things all over the place? I mean, how can we make it easier to not be exposed to these really tempting high fat, high calorie foods?
Well, as you said, most people actually are in support of information. Mm-hmm. So I think whereas, I think if you looked at the calorie count on a bloomin' onion, as I have, you'd realize it's going to be a meal for a family of six as opposed to an individual serving.
An appetizer.
And that should be an appetizer. So that I think having information is helpful. So I personally like the fact that when you look at a menu, you not only know the type of food, but you might have a sense of what ingredients are in the food and also the total number of calories. So the Affordable Care Act does many things in health insurance and health care, but it also mandates that fast food restaurants and large chains provide information to people that's readily available, not behind the counter where you have to ask for it, but it's on the menu.
Is there a way to make the numbers easier to understand? Because when you see just a raw number of calories, it may not make sense. But if you said something like you said, this is a family's caloric intake for a day in this one appetizer. Is there a way to make that more evocative?
Well, not only that. Yes. So we should all have a sense of our caloric requirements, whether, you look on the box and it says that's an average of 2,000 calories a day. I think the other thing is to watch out for the serving size, is that sometimes you'll look and you'll say, oh, this looks like a good amount of calories, and then you realize what you're about to consume should be is three servings. So you need to triple the number of calories. So I think providing the information is a good first step, allowing people to, if they're going to make informed choices, to have information.
Rob Verrett talking to Patrick Remington about obesity and overweight America. What can we do about the health risks? Back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We've got John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hello. I've heard the mortality for adults from obesity is between 100,000 and 200,000 people per year. I just wonder if you'd comment on that. Also, what you're thinking are the best statistics on the current overweight/obesity rates for children and adults. I'd just like to chime in here on this thing about big government. I believe in big democratic government, and I believe in preventative health. And I think anybody that argues against preventative health for society is absolutely wrong. We all pay for Medicare, Medicaid, private health insurance costs, disability costs. Every last one of these are impacted by the hypertension, the secondary diabetes, the joint destruction, the hypercholesterolemia. Everything is related to this obesity epidemic.
Gotcha. I'll jump in there, John, because you gave us a lot to chew on there. Let's start with that last point first. We're all affected down the road by these problems, so let's support preventative care, it sounds like.
Well, there's no question that we're all part of society, and we have a commitment to insurance that we share in other people's misfortune if they do get sick. In fact, we have universal insurance. It's just for some people that's delivered in an emergency room, high cost and often futile care. Once you buy into the model of shared responsibility for health care costs, I agree that we should then have a model where we have shared responsibility for preventive care. And so that preventive care should be universally accessible and provided at low or no cost to individuals. So I couldn't agree more. The question about total number of deaths due to obesity That's a large number, 100 to 200,000. And yes, research has shown that if we looked at the mortality experience of people who are normal weight or now maybe slightly overweight, that the number of people who are obese, they've increased the risk in the population. So there are hundreds of thousands of people dying prematurely from obesity and obesity-related complications.
And then he asked about kids. Do you have a sense of the stats on overweight obesity for kids?
Well, there's no question. The rates of obesity in kids have doubled or tripled in the last 20 years. And you don't have to know statistics to know that. Just look at kids today, look at schools, talk to pediatricians. The good news is, in the last year, communities from New York to California, even Mississippi, have seen rates of child obesity beginning to decline. So not only did we suspect that you could design healthy schools with lots of physical activity and healthy foods, we're actually starting to see it have effects on kids. We're nowhere near where we need to be. If you go into your school and look at the school lunch, ask yourself whether you'd consider that to be a healthy diet. And also, just go in and sit with a young kids in school and get the sense of whether they're getting the exercise they need. Yes, we need more time for math and science, but kids aren't going to learn if they're not healthy, and they're not going to be healthy if they're not exercising and moving about.
Thanks for the call, John, and bringing up those issues. We'll go now to Jamie in Appleton. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. Couple questions for Patrick real quick. First, if you're familiar with Dr. Cooper and the Cooper Institute in Texas, he came out with a study a couple years ago that indicated that blue-collar workers' life expectancy is rapidly decreasing as white-collar employees or workers are increasing, and much of that due to the education level, lifestyle, obviously what they eat and drink. So that's question number one, if you could answer. And then two, real quick, I am in favor of taxing harmful items like soda, candies, things like that. I, however, am not in favor of the government mandating the rest of us to pay for people who want to abuse themselves by eating unhealthy foods or sodas and whatnot. However, the government can already control the problem further upstream and start mandating the schools and start teaching everybody how to eat healthy before they make a blue-collar or white-collar decision later on in life.
Gotcha. Not much time left, Jamie, so I'll jump in there. First of all, you'd think blue-collar is probably more active than white-collar workers, but a higher mortality rate. But Jamie kind of answered his own question there. There might be other factors involved apart from sedentary versus active lifestyle.
Well, it is true. We've seen a growing disparity between health and life expectancy and social and economic status, blue-collar versus white-collar workers. And that's largely related to health risks. The old days of blue-collar workers being more active than white-collar are not true anymore. And he also points out the fact that we shouldn't be paying for other people's poor decisions, but we do. We don't turn people away from the emergency room when they come in with a heart attack, even if they don't have insurance. So we already, as a society, have agreed to pay those health care costs. To me, that makes sense that we should also agree to do the things upstream, focused on prevention, to keep people healthy. So as long as we've accepted the responsibility of caring for people when they get sick, we should also accept the responsibility of providing healthy environments and healthy places so people can make the right choices.
Thanks for the call, Jamie. Now we have Diana with us in Wausau. Hi, Diana.
Hi. I really have some personal issues here because I have food allergies. I'm allergic to wheat and corn and sugars, and I don't even like to go out to eat because most restaurants, when I ask them, what's in your dressing? Because if I have a corn syrup in there, I'm in trouble. Then they will say, we don't know. So I think the restaurants really need to have an extremely detailed list of ingredients for people like myself. And the other thing is that people need to know that there is help out there that's free for people who have a problem with overeating. And the help is in Overeaters Anonymous.
Gotcha. And probably other help out there. What do you think, Patrick Remington? She supports restaurant labeling for more than just calorie counts.
Well, studies have shown that people who in general eat
out. Eat at restaurants and fast food restaurants. Don't eat as healthy a diet. One of the reasons is when you actually prepare your own food, you're more likely to put in healthy ingredients, less sugar, less salt than is done when being prepared by someone else. So I agree. I think not only should we ask restaurants and other places to let us know what's in the food, but if you try and spend more time eating food that you've prepared yourself, you're going to eat a healthier diet on balance.
That reminds me, at a restaurant once I had these amazing potato tacos, and I've tried to make them and I can never touch it, and I realize I do not have the guts to use as much butter as they must have used.
And most soups, when people prepare soups at home, they would never put in salt teaspoon after teaspoon. Mm-hmm. That's done with the soups that are prepared in restaurants.
In our last minute or so, you mentioned earlier some good news, some good signs in a couple states with child obesity going down. Do you see other cause for optimism?
Well, I do. I think the first approach in public health is to recognize that there's a problem. We now realize that obesity is a major problem in this community. You've heard from the callers. People are concerned about their own health. The second issue is provide people with the information they need to make the right choices. But I think if you stop there, we'll be very frustrated that those healthy choices are really hard to make today. And so I think it's a time to come together as a society, beginning, you know, in your society at home, making the decisions to have a healthy household, but all the way up to schools, communities, and even the state and federal government. Come together, make those policy decisions that help us all make the healthy choices that we all want to.
Patrick Remington, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Patrick Remington. He is professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison, associate dean of public health at UW-Madison's School of Medicine. Our Monday morning wake-up call is coming up, a way to lose a tiny bit of weight, donating blood. That's coming up in just a minute. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid-30s. Tonight, mostly clear, lows in the teens and 20s. Tomorrow, turning cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 30s, lows in the teens and 20s. Coming up next hour, it's the State Capitol Report. Some elections in the works and a new session of the state legislature. WPR State Government Reporter Sean Johnson will be here to tell us all about it. Now it's time for our Monday morning wake-up call. This week's edition is all about your blood and why you might want to share some of it. Bobby Sneathan is with the Red Cross, and she issues this week's wake-up call. She's program manager in communications for the Badger Hawkeye Red Cross region. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, January is National Blood Donor Month. Why is this an important time of year to get the word out about giving blood?
You know, this month we're recognizing and thanking all the dedicated donors who do make time to give blood. And it also comes at an opportune time because January can be an especially challenging month to collect blood donations due to, inclement weather, seasonal illness, and just, you know, reminding folks to take time. So the need for blood is constant, and whenever anyone is eligible or has an opportunity to donate, we ask that they do so. So this is just a month where we're obviously celebrating and reminding folks about the importance of donating blood.
Well, looking back a couple months, we had the Superstorm Sandy out east, and it made me think, you know, you kind of get a double whammy when you have a disaster like that. On one hand, you need more blood, right? But on the other hand, because people can't get out and donate blood, at the same time you've got this high demand, the supply is getting hit too. Is that right?
Very true. Just a couple of months ago, we had almost 400 blood drives that were canceled on the East Coast, and we asked folks in the, you know, parts that were unaffected to step up and donate, you know, here in the Midwest. And we saw those people pour out in numbers, which is outstanding. And, we saw the best of people in a response effort like that, either if they made a financial donation or a blood donation. And those people who donated might be eligible now because you're eligible to give every 56 days. But that's certainly true. And we always want to be prepared in an emergency because it's the blood on the shelves that helps save lives. And once you donate, it could take a couple days for that blood to be tested and then ready for a patient to receive that blood.
And just give us a little more detail. Once we've given our blood, where does it go? What happens and who gets it?
Now, once you donate blood, we take that sample and we send it to one of our national testing labs to ensure that it's safe for a patient to receive your blood. And again, that could take a few days. And then once you donate blood, we'll meet our local hospital needs first. So any patient in need of life-saving blood products, whether it's a cancer patient, a transplant recipient, trauma victim, we'll send those blood products to our local hospitals. And if those needs are already met, we can ship blood wherever it's needed in the country. And that's something that we certainly saw during Superstorm Sandy.
Now, for somebody who hasn't donated blood ever or maybe in a long time, where should they go? How should they reach out to give blood?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we always encourage people to head to our website, which is redcrossblood.org. Get familiar with the process because obviously we don't want any surprises. And there's some tips that we have for people who've never donated before, as well as our seasoned donors. So, you know, it's important to drink water, get a good night's rest, eat a healthy meal prior to coming in. But, you know, the entire process, we say, plan on about an hour from the time you walk in to the time you leave. Once you register, you're going to answer a few questions. We're going to give you a mini physical, check your heart rate, your blood pressure, and your iron. The actual donation process itself is, you know, just a pinch, and it takes about 8 minutes on average. And then we'll ask you to stick around, have some refreshments, and make sure that you're feeling okay. And in that hour, you can help save up to 3 lives with one donation. So it's a very simple way to give back. And it's safe and it's necessary because we encourage people who are eligible to donate.
And we have drives at our workplace from time to time. I know a lot of times you send out the mobile blood collection vehicle or whatever you call it. How can people make this happen at their workplace?
Yeah, we, you know, in addition to that, we do have donation centers across the state, in Eau Claire, La Crosse, Madison, Green Bay, as well as Pewaukee. And but we do rely heavily on people, volunteer coordinators in the community to host blood drives. So, you know, whether it's at your church or your school or in your community, it's an extremely important, you know, facet of our operation. And if you're interested in hosting a blood drive, we certainly encourage you to also check out the website or give us a call at 1-800-RED-CROSS, and we can walk you through, you know, maybe some of the requirements that or what to expect when you would like to host a blood drive and how you can help recruit donors.
And even if you don't get the Red Cross to come and visit you, I see signs at the donation center. People kind of donate as teams where I do it this week, my coworker does it next week, or my, you know, my bowling team or whatever group of people can make a pact to be regular blood donors. How does that work?
Yes, and in this region we have what's called a one-a-week donor club where we encourage people or businesses or groups to, you know, make at least 52 annual donations a year. So you can donate on behalf of your church or your club, and those binders will be at all of our blood drives so that you can sign and, you know, add to the tally and show that, you know, you're supporting your group who is obviously making a really important contribution if you aren't able to host. So it's very prevalent here in Wisconsin, and we encourage people to, you know, get involved that way too. It's a little less effort, but anybody who has the time and space and capacity to host a blood drive, it's extremely important as well.
Now, some years back, I was donating, and the phlebotomist, the collector, said, "You have really big veins." And they meant that as a compliment, and they said that made me a good candidate for donating plasma and platelets to the Red Cross, and I've been doing that since. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, yes, that is a compliment when you hear that from one of our phlebotomists.
But only from a Red Cross worker.
Some people who donate whole blood, we learned that they might be a good candidate for platelet donation, and that is a little bit more lengthy. It's done at our donation centers. We don't take those machines out on the road. But what we'll do is we'll contact you if you donated whole blood, and we'll say, you know, maybe based on your blood type, your platelet count, after we run those tests, we learn that, you know, you're a good candidate for platelet donation, which are also very important. That's a component of your blood that, you know, it's extremely important in cancer patient treatment. It's a clotting factor. But that process does take a little bit longer, and those platelets only have a shelf life of 5 days. So you can donate that more frequently, every 7 days, up to 24 times a year, whereas with whole blood, which most people are used to, that's every 56 days, up to 6 times a year. So if you do receive a call from the Red Cross saying that you're a good candidate for that, you know, certainly you can also check out our website or just ask some questions as to what that would entail. It is a little more lengthy procedure, so we understand that it doesn't fit into everyone's schedule, but we do have some outstandingly dedicated donors who do that on a regular basis as well.
We're out of time. Bobbi Sneathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Bobby Sneathan issuing this week's Wake Up Call. She's Program Manager in Communications for the Badger-Hawkeye Red Cross Region. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, Amanda Magnus, and Bill Martins for producing this morning's program. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for answering the phone, Cynthia Schuster for on-air direction as well. Stick around, the State Capitol Report is coming up, and there's always more to come here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network.